You're listening to episode 103 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers, a very warm welcome to our new 88 Cups of Tea listeners. As a quick overview of our podcast, I interview really inspiring and awesome storytellers in hopes that their personal experiences and advice will shake you out of your funk and make you feel less alone. For all of my listeners who've been with us for a while, thank you for hanging out with us every week. You are bomb.com, and a massive hug to our listeners who've recommended and shared our podcast with friends and took the time to leave us iTunes ratings and reviews. If you're looking for a sense of family with a bunch of people who understand the highs and lows of being a writer, you should seriously join our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I love this community of ours, and I always have the best time checking in to hear how everyone is doing. We check in almost every day to talk about our work in progress, our latest achievements, and current reads, and so much more. We seriously have the most encouraging and supportive members in our group, so you don't want to miss out on this special community. Come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. In today's new episode, we have award-winning and New York Times bestselling author Maria V. Snyder of the Study series. I'm excited to finally share this episode with you. Maria is so much fun to talk to and gives really eye-opening advice and shares some really memorable personal stories. In our conversation, you'll learn what inspired the idea for Maria's novel, Poison Study, the first book to kick off the Study series, and we have a detailed look inside her creative research and writing process and what her revision process is like. We discuss the importance of creating a story bible and keeping track of the details when writing a book series and how to develop and maintain romantic relationships throughout a series. Further into our chat, you'll also learn how writing and critique groups create deadlines and provide support for your writing. And Maria shares advice on finding your voice as a mother and a writer and how to create intentional writing time with a busy schedule. Now let's jump right in. Listeners, we have Maria V. Snyder with us today. Maria, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I am so good, and I am so excited to have you on the podcast. I know there's a lot of listeners who are huge, huge supporters and admirers of yours, and they love your books and your work. Maria, I was reading your bio, and you were a meteorologist before. You studied meteorology from Pennsylvania State University. How freaking cool is that?
That's pretty cool. I think it is. It certainly helps with my books, especially the storm ones. I use that background into my writing. It's cool that I get to merge both passions.
I would love to dive into that a little bit more. What kind of jobs did you have with that degree?
I started out working as an environmental meteorologist, which was dealing with like air pollution studies and air dispersion modeling, which is a lot of big words.
Yeah, I was like, whoa.
Basically, it's computer modeling. You have a facility that is going to pollute the atmosphere, unfortunately, and they need to find out the people who live downwind of them, how much they're going to be breathing in of the stuff that's coming out of their stacks. That's what dispersion modeling is. So I did a lot of air pollution sampling and studies to make sure that it was healthy for the people that around the facility so they could get their air permit.
Whoa. Okay. That's really different from being an author. How was the transition?
I don't miss it at all. So working in an office and dealing with governments and lawyers and everything, it was just a big hassle. I think it really helped with my writing. I really did enjoy the creative aspect of the fiction writing. I mean, I started out writing short stories, science fiction short stories, because I had that whole science background. And I was very comfortable with trying to take the science, predict 10, 15 years in the future and see what was it going to be and things like that. That was nice. Being able to use that in my writing was a lot of fun. I think when I approach fiction, too, that whole logical background helps me out with keeping my plot logic on task. In fact, when my first editor started working with me, she was like, there's no plot holes in this. And I was like, quite proud of that.
I love that you're able to transplant that skill, right? I think that's so cool. Do you remember that first time where you're in the middle of doing your job, measuring the pollution, and then, hey, I just want to write? Where was that thought process?
When I was in college, I read a lot of books, fiction, you know, science fiction, fantasy. I did start trying to write a novel, I remember, in college. But, you know, you have like hardly any free time in college. So I kind of dabbled with the idea. I've always been a big daydreamer. When I get bored, my mind starts going off into these adventures that I would have. Of course, I'd be the star of the adventures. And, you know, I'd be sitting at my desk at school, and all of a sudden it would be a cataclysm and the earth would flood and my desk would turn into a boat and I would be the lone survivor. So when I was actually at work and we were bored, there was no jobs because I worked for a consulting firm, and it was really interesting how it was either lots of jobs at once or nothing. And the summer times tend to be really boring because when you're working for another company, all their employees are on vacation in the summertime. So nobody wants to deal with a consultant at that time. So they tend, starting September to June, we were very busy. But the summer months just drag. I had all these daydreams and stuff. I'm like, well, I might as well start writing down. Plus, I'll look busy too if anybody walks by my cubicle. Oh, there's Maria, man. She's writing furiously. Must be coming up with a great marketing plan. You know,
I don't know. Good thinking. I like that.
So that's really how it came about. I was just bored at work and trying to do something between jobs.
Did you have a family yet?
I didn't have a family yet. It was pretty much right after college when I was working in a new area. I didn't know many people in the area. So too, that was another thing. Like came home at night, I didn't have much to do because I had my apartment. So that's another thing. You know, I would just start picking up where I left off at work, things like that, go to the library, do a little research.
Afterwards, when you did end up having a family, you were already, I guess I would say, a full-time author by then?
Not quite. When my son was born, I switched to working part-time because the company was very happy with part-time because, again, with consulting, you get jobs in and then you sit. So part-time is then they only would call you in when they had work, which was benefited us both. So I was home with my son a good part of the time, and I was really sleep deprived, and I had this idea, well, I'm going to write a novel.
Wow.
He was just little, and, you know, during nap times or at night when he was sleeping, I started working on this novel. I had gotten this idea for, actually, it ended up being Poison Study.
Wow. So you say you got this idea, but let's unpack that a little bit. What do you mean? Like, how specific was this, I got an idea light bulb? Like,
it was really interesting because there is a specific time. I was reading a book by Orson Scott Card called How to Write Science Fiction and Fantasy. In the book, he was talking about characters and how you want to choose your characters for your fantasy or science fiction. And he was going on about monarchy and how kings and queens are very powerful, but they don't have a lot of freedom. Can you imagine William and Kate trying to solve mysteries? It would be impossible.
It's like clearly they were not doing their job.
Yeah, so he was like, try and think of people who are off the center of power, but who are close enough to be witness to it. And then bing, in my head, I have this idea for a food taster because they're there. I grew up Italian, so everything that happened in my family happened in the kitchen.
I was going to say, do you have a special relationship with food?
Yes, everything happens in the kitchen, you know, all the drama, everything. Here I was thinking, you know, about a food taster. And there was another reason I thought of a food taster is because my husband worked a candy company, Mars Chocolate. Part of his job was developing recipes and formulas and tasting chocolate.
That sounds so good. Are you joking me right now? That's so awesome.
He made a living as a chocolate taster.
I'm just like here salivating away.
Yes. He was also doing that. So I was hearing a lot about different kinds of textures and taste and flavors and flavanols and cocoa polyphenols.
Dang.
And things like that. And it was just getting into my brain. When I read about somebody close to the center of power and I thought of a food taster, of course, I had all this expertise in my house.
Amazing. When you ran that idea with your hubby, what did he say?
He thinks that chocolate is a magical substance. So he was like, well, that makes perfect sense to me. He was very enthusiastic. He brought me home all these articles on tasting. I learned way more about the tongue than I really needed to know for the book, but he was really supportive.
Exactly. I was going to say, it shows that you have a very supportive hubby, and that was super sweet of him and very thoughtful. What about your family? I'm sure they were thrilled to hear that a food taster was the main part of your story.
Well, they were a little on the young side when I was working on it. Later on, when they were a little older and they knew about this, they decided that they needed to taste my food for me to make sure there was no poisons in it. The only thing is, they were just really concerned about my dessert. They didn't care if anybody poisoned my broccoli. Those cookies were very suspicious to them.
Marie, I love your sense of humor.
They had a good time with that.
Clearly, that broccoli and that spinach, that looks A-okay. Don't even worry about it, Mom. It just passed. No. Talking about that, most of our podcast listeners, many of them are moms. This is just from an outsider's point of view, looking into your own life. From what I see in the public image is that you have it all together. You're a kick-ass mom, but you make time as an author. You don't lose yourself, and you're killing it. And again, that's just me making assumptions from what I see, knowing that we have listeners who are feeling a bit stuck. Is there any words of advice or your own experiences that you can share that might be able to rattle them up and shake them up and find their voice again?
That's a hard one, because motherhood is really demanding mm-hmm. of your time and your energy and everything. I found, too, that when I was home with the kids, a lot of my husband's colleagues, as soon as they hear, oh, you're a stay-at-home mom, they would just pretty much dismiss me as not somebody worth talking to because I couldn't be interesting. This was prior to being published as well. It took me a while. It took me like 5 years to write Poison Study while I was raising the kid and everything. So it wasn't a fast process. I did do some nonfiction articles for a local newspaper. It was funny. It's called the Senior News. Oh. And I did features on people who were retired, but were doing some pretty fantastic stuff. I always thought once you got older, that was it. You were just sit home and watch TV all day. Yep. But no, these people were showing me that they were doing all kinds of great stuff. That helped get me out of the house and get me talking to other people. I think that's important. I think, too, if they can find some kind of writer's group, a critique group or support group. I had a critique group we met once a month. And for that once a month, I had plan to get one chapter done, and I could do one chapter a month and submit it. So not only were they supportive and giving me feedback, but also too, it was like a deadline. It was like having, okay, I need to have this chapter done for my critique group to have. So that also helped me get through the whole process of writing Poison Study because I had sort of a deadline. I think that's important as well. So if they can't meet up with people in person and maybe also online. There's a lot of writers groups where they give each other challenges. They have things where, okay, let's try and get this many words written this week. Check in with me. Tell me how you're doing. I think getting support from other writers is really important. And I think that would help them. And also, too, to carve out time. Look, hey, this is my time to write. And to be very, very strict about it. Because when the people find out that you're home, they assume that you can do anything. Like my husband would call and say, hey, can you go pick up the taxes? They're ready. And I'm like, yeah, well, I can go pick them up at 4. And he goes, well, I could do that. I'm like, well, I'm not leaving in the middle of my afternoon to go pick up the taxes. It took him a little bit to realize that. Oh, and my mother would call me and she was so funny. She'd be like, oh, I know you're writing. I know you're working, but I'll only be a minute. And like an hour later, we were still talking. So, you know, the Italian mother.
I was going to say my mom must be Italian there somewhere.
Yes, you have. You have Italian in your blood.
I'm telling you, I think I do.
Far back in your history. This was before caller ID. This was a while ago when I finally did get caller ID because I would answer the phone when your kids are at school and there's a problem. They'll call you and then you don't want to miss that call because they won't leave a message. Yeah. They'll go to the next person on your list. And I'm like, okay, so I have to answer the phone. But then I got caller ID, and that was great because she'd call, and I'd just say, oh, it's my mom. I'll call her back later. But then she figured out I had caller ID, and then the messages she would leave. Maria, I know you're home. I know you're home. This will only take a minute. Why won't you pick up for your mother?
I get that. Just backtracking also to your husband saying, hey, I could get it at 4 p.m. Oh, then I can get it as well. That's a conversation I feel like is so common, and it pops up a lot with a lot of listeners. I mean, even myself, my family, when they call in or I call them and they're in New York, I moved out to LA. My mom would say, okay, this is years ago when I was working on my acting. Well, she changed a lot. So she's a lot more understanding and really cool right now. But back then she was like, what are you doing with your time? I don't get it. You're literally doing nothing. You're not currently at an audition. So you have time to talk to me and answer these questions. first of all, you coming in here is completely disrespecting my art, disrespecting my time, and making me feel like crap. It's not helpful having a conversation like that, saying you're not doing anything right now, or what you're doing right now is not important because you're not actually in the middle of acting or driving to the audition or working on set or filming. So you must be free. You got to draw the line and the boundaries. Just getting a little bit deeper, that conversation that you have with your husband, he sounds great in that he's very understanding. How would you advise our listeners approach that conversation if they're nervous approaching their significant other or even their children about their office hours, about writing?
It can be hard. And I must say, for my husband was very, or still is, very, very supportive. I mean, I went away to writing conferences when I was still learning. My writer's group every month, he knew that was my time, and he had no problems with any of that. So he was super supportive. That was just those beginning issues with being at home and being available to do stuff. Once I told him, he was very, oh, okay. But that's my husband. I know having a conversation, sometimes I think too, men look at things differently than women. And I think if you put it out in a very logical, okay, this is my goals, this is what I like to achieve, this is the time I need, like, can you be supportive of that? If you lay it out in a very logical way, I think that helps. Because if you just say you're writing, if they don't know what you're working on, now for me, it's like, I'm working on a novel, I like to get it done in a year, and I need this time. And that might help come up with a plan, like a business plan almost, so that they know that your writing is not just some creative me time. And if you're publishing independently, then you're going to want to have your book done and out and edit it certain times. I know with my kids, the hardest thing, I used to take the summers off and not write. So we would have fun at the summers, and then I would write while they were at school. And that worked for a while until I had a 2 books deadline in 1 year. And suddenly I'm faced with a summer where I needed to write. It was really interesting. I tried to do the whole writing and okay, they can go play because they're old enough. They could pretty much amuse themselves, but they kept coming into the office. And I even closed my door and they still kept coming in. But I noticed, I had this epiphany. I noticed that in the mornings when I would sleep, they wouldn't bother me. They wouldn't bother me at all. They wait. And when I woke up, they'd be like, let's have breakfast. Let's do stuff.
Aww.
But until the point that I woke up, they would amuse themselves. So I was like, okay, here's an idea. I'm going to write at night because I'm a night owl anyway. So I'm going to put everybody to bed by 9 and I'm going to write from 10 to like 2.
Wow.
And then I'm going to go to sleep and they're going to let me sleep till like 10 or noon. And then we're going to go and have a fun afternoon and evening because I know I'm going to write when they go to bed. So I'm not stressing about getting my pages done. It was just like so life changing for me when that happened. And it also helped that there was a summer morning camp for the kids, like from 9 to 12, they could go
to this play.
It was called a playground program and they loved it. It was only 3 hours a day. And my sister-in-law, who was so helpful, she would pick them up at 8:45 and take them in and then bring them back at noon. And I'd be up. I'd give them lunch. We go to the pool. We go to the park. We go have fun. It was perfect.
Wow. You got a great support system too.
I do.
In-law stepping in. I never really hear that.
Oh, yes.
That's really cool. Your in-law knew about your plan or to write and your timeline, right?
And I asked her because I know my kids like this playground program, but it would involve me getting up at 8 to get them there on time. But if I'm going to bed at 2 or 3 a.m., that's tough. She's home because she worked at the school and her son also likes the program. So I said to her, well, hey, how about you take the 3 kids in and out and bring them back and I'll pay for your son's tuition for the program.
Oh, perfect.
In exchange. And she was like, that's great. So she got 3 hours of free time in the morning.
Oh my gosh, perfect.
She's a morning person. She would take her son and my kids in and then she'd have 3 hours to herself. It worked out perfectly. She's really great. We're good friends. We're neighbors. She lives right next door. And our kids are similar ages.
Great cousins, like best friend cousins in a way. Oh, that's lucky.
Yes.
The great thing about cousins, if you are close, is that you're close, but it's also not so close where you'll end up fighting all the time like most siblings do. And you do have that space. My cousin and my sisters, they're like siblings. At the same time, because he was raised in his own home, it ends up being, he is like a brother, but with the benefits where you don't have to always see him every second of the day to the point where he might get on your nerves or you might get on his nerves. I think that was a really great advice that you shared, especially about the conversation, if listeners have never had that conversation with their significant other, and also ideas for them to figure out how they can find writing time and squeeze that in and make intentional space for your writing around your children's schedule too, and just to make sure you have a balance of both. Thank you for that, Maria.
It's important, and I don't know, it's if you're an early morning person, maybe get up before the kids are awake and do some work then, or in the evening after they go to sleep. I would bring a notepad and paper to soccer practices and stuff so I could sit there and work but still be there.
See, that's smart. You're making so much time. There's so many people who have all the time in the world and don't even have children, they don't have families, they're not married. Yet, they don't produce as much work. It just shows, I think, when you're very intentional about your time, you can get the work done. There really is no excuse.
Things like practices or camps. Like at one time, I took my kids down to a volleyball camp, and it was 50 minutes away. So I didn't really want to drive home and then drive back, because that would have been 3.5 hours in a car. So I just went and took my computer, and while they were in the volleyball camp, I just worked on my stories.
Maria, you're so kick-ass. I would love to dive into more of your writing world. And I know you mentioned that during your time in school studying, you read a lot. Was there a fiction that stood out to you that changed your mind about fiction? And you're like, holy moly, this is what writing can do to people.
No.
I love the big breath leading into it. I was like, no.
And then it's like, no. I've always read books. I mean, my mother read to me when I was little, and my sister read to me when I was little, and my father, I remember my father even reading to me when I was little. I must have just pestered everybody in the household to read to me. So books have always been a part of my life. We made weekly trips to the library to take our books in and get new ones out, and that was always a fun trip. And my mother was a big reader. She still is a big reader. So I just progressed from like the kids' books to then I was reading mysteries. I really liked mysteries and the whole whodunit and solve the puzzle type stories. And then my sister started dating her future husband, and he was big into science fiction fantasy. He was like, well, have you ever read any of those books? And I'm like, no. He gave me, I think it was On a Pale Horse by Piers Anthony. Oh. I think that was the first fantasy book I read, and it was the incarnation of death. Oh, and A Spell for Chameleon. I think that was the other Piers Anthony that he gave me as well. And it was just sort of like, wow, this is really different. And this is really unique. And I really enjoyed it. So I started reading more science fiction and fantasy. When I started getting ideas for my own stories, they tended to go in that genre as well.
That is a good memory to have, just how you got into it. Do you give thanks to your sister's now husband?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I bet he's just walking around like, yep, that was me.
I think I dedicated tea glass to him.
He must be so freaking touched.
I guess. I don't know.
Now that you mentioned sea glass, that world that you created, the series, you were able to weave in your meteorology background. Please, let's dive into that.
In the study books, the poison study, magic study, fire study, were the three books first set in that world. And then I introduced the character in fire study, Opal, who, when I did the spin-off glass books from that world, I used her as the main character. I think it's fire study. I mentioned this group of magicians called the Storm Dancers. I threw that out there because I thought it sounded cool, but I wasn't quite sure what they did. It was just something that I happened to come up with when I was writing it. When I needed Opal to have her first story, Storm Glass, I didn't have it named. I think the working title was Glass Study because of the whole study books and now with the glass. So I was working on that with the storm. And what happened was when 2005, when Hurricane Katrina came and did all that destruction and killed all those people, I remember thinking about how much energy those hurricanes have. And they do so much destruction. And it's like, oh, I wish we could somehow harness the energy from those storms. And we could just like suck it out, because a hurricane can produce enough energy to fuel the entire world.
Holy, I did not know that.
For a day, within a couple hours of hurricane energy, you can fuel the world for a day.
You are kidding.
No.
Like all the electricity, all of that?
Yes, yes, all of it. That's how much energy those storms pack, which is why they do so much damage.
Oh my God. God, if there is a way to just use it.
Yes, I'm like, oh, it's a shame we can't just take it out of the storm and bottle it and use that energy elsewhere. Then that's where the spark came. You can't do that in real life, unfortunately. but I can do that in my story world. I could have storm dancers who go out into these storms, sort of like those hurricane hunters, and they will harvest the energy from the storms and bottle it in these glass orbs.
Oh,
and then the glass orbs get used in factories to fuel factories as a clean source of energy. So that also comes back to my environmental meteorology, because I've turned in not a big tree hugger, but I'm really about saving the environment and stuff. So that's clean energy. And then we're using glass because glass is the most wonderful material in the world. It can be melted down and reused over and over and over again. So anyway, so I had this in my book, and then that came with the problem for storm glass was they had these storm dancers bottling this energy, but somebody was sabotaging the glass orbs and they were shattering. And when an orb shatters, that glass is like a tornado, mm-hmm. and it's killing storm dancers. They have to bring in a glass expert, and that's Opal, to kind of figure out what's going on with this whole situation. And it was all from Hurricane Katrina and my desire not have that happen to people again. That year, we had five Category 5 hurricanes that year. I mean, it was like Emily and Rita, Katrina and Wilma, Fred, Barney, and Bam Bam, I think it was.
Wait, I did not hear Bam Bam.
I'm kidding. You're too young.
I was like, wait, hold up.
The people who watched the Flintstones will be laughing right now when they were younger.
Well, listen, I used to watch the Flintstones. I had a dream. I was the one with the dark hair, and I was literally racing in my dream, and I woke up with my heart racing and thinking I was still in the race. So that all was from Hurricane Katrina and just from that event. And then it just catapulted into this entire idea of all that power being harnessed into the sea glass. Holy moly. When you have these ideas and thoughts, do you normally sketch down your ideas or do you write it down, or is it all in your head and you just can kind of spill it all out?
I write them down. I get very old fashioned. I get a notebook, an actual paper spiral bound notebook. That's my book for all my details and research for each novel. So in my storm glass notebook, I wrote down the idea about the orbs and harvesting the energy and things like that, so that I had it down. And I did some research. I actually did some calculations to see just how much energy you can get from one of these storms. That brought me back to my days as a meteorology major, because we did a lot of equations to figure out various movements of air and, you know, energy produced. Even something like condensing, when moisture condenses into droplets, that releases amount of energy there too.
Dang, Maria, you sound so sexy right now talking about all these equations. Yes, please keep going. Do you mind if I jump in, because now is like the perfect time with listener questions? Hillary Avis Reese from our group, she would love to know how you approach planning a series. Do you complete the series story arc before you begin? Do you plot out the whole series or plan each book after writing the previous one?
That is a good question. And I get asked that quite a bit, because I do have 9 novels all set in the same world with similar characters, and 6 of them have the same 2 main characters. I wish I was organized enough that I plot everything out and I knew all the books ahead of time like some authors do. But I'm definitely a pantser in this case. It's interesting because I have that whole science background and I'm organized that way. But when I'm writing a story, I just kind of go, I get the idea. Like with Poison Study, I had the idea that she was going to be a food taster and this is how I was going to set up the world. But I had no idea where it was going, or the fact that I was going to get all these books from that world. I just developed it as I went and discovered the story as I wrote it. When I finished the book and I went back through and cleaned it up and made it flow, I realized, oh, I have potential for another story, because she develops magic and, well, she needs to explore her magical abilities and learn about them. So I could do a second book. But I didn't write the second book until I thought, well, there's no point writing a second book till I sell the first book. At that time, self-publishing was not a thing at all. In fact, it was not a career killer, but it was not looked upon favorably because we didn't have these great e-readers and apps and everything like that. So I'm like, if I don't sell Poison Study, I'm not going to write Magic Study. But now for independent authors, it's best to write 3 books first and then put them out every couple months, so get the momentum going. I wish I could say I had this great plotting method, or I used the spreadsheets and all that other stuff, but no, I just kind of winged it for everything. But I do say it's rarely really important to keep track of the details. Definitely, if you're thinking you're going to be writing more book, write down more details. Because when I did Poison Study, I didn't write many details down. And actually, I didn't write many details down for the first three books. And then when I started getting into further books, I was like, oh, what happened? I actually have to take the book off the shelf and flip through it to find out. And that was a time waster. When I was writing the new set of study books, the Shadow, Night, and Dawn study, mm-hmm. I had a Natalie. She's my chief evil minion. And she was like, you know, can I help you in any way? And I'm like, well, I could really use a spreadsheet for all to keep track of all the characters, like their physical descriptions, who they know, clothing, weapons, everything. And she put together this phenomenal spreadsheet. It's like a thing of beauty.
Wow.
Yes. And she did this for me just out of pure love. I sent her all these signed books and all these t-shirts and stuff to thank her because she didn't want any compensation for her time. She was having fun. Wow. With it, but that really, really helped. If you are a type that just kind of wings it, keep track of your notes because that really will help out in the long runs.
I don't think I heard of that before. There's a lot of authors that we had on the show that do pants a lot. We don't really talk about notes and keeping it in tracks. Thank you for that heads up.
Some people call it a story Bible to keep track of everything. I have my notebooks, like I can go back and see, oh, did I use that name before? How did I describe that character? I do have those kind of notes. But being able to pull it up like on Excel and just click on a character and have everything come up about them made things so much easier. Yeah.
Faster. Oy, oy, oy. How much of it did you have to do research for and how long was the research process?
Well, it all depends on the topic. With Poison Study, I did some research ahead of time about food tasting.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is definitely a science as well as an art. And learning about how that works. And I did some research on poisons, but I couldn't find ones that did what I wanted them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out you really can't poison your children and call it research. The police really frown on that. I mean, why do you have these children if you cannot experiment?
I know.
Seriously?
I have to say you'd be an incredible actor because you would be a method actor. You'd be committed as hell.
There you go. So things like beautiful things about fantasy is you could make things up mm-hmm. as long as you keep things consistent. Certain things you have to do some research ahead of time, but other things like as I'm going along and I mentioned something like the indigo plant where they used to get the ink for the pens was from indigo plants and I've never seen one. So I just put a bracket in the middle of my story and say, describe plant here. Instead of stopping to do the research and getting online and wasting an hour, I just put a bracket there. And then at the end of the book, I go back and all the places I had brackets, then I would do all the research. Right now I'm working on a story and I'm like, I need to know what the hardest substance is. Is it still a diamond or have we developed something new substance? So I'll just put insert hard substance here and then I'll go and do the research all when I have it collected. But things like, you know, with the glass books, I did really need to know the whole glass blowing, how that worked. So I found a local, not quite local, it's about an hour away, place that actually had classes that you can go and work with molten glass and learn how to do things and blow it and shape it, basically singe your eyebrows off, that kind of thing. Because you're looking in the kiln a little too close.
Well, thank you for sacrificing your eyebrows for us.
It's like, oh, you want me to put this metal rod into this molten liquid and I don't wear gloves because you lose your sensitivity? Oh, there go the knuckle hairs. I didn't need them anyway. Who needs knuckle hairs, really?
Free waxing situation here.
The fun thing about doing hands-on research, because it's important in some cases, is because you get that experience. You know, you get to feel the heat from the kiln on your face. You get to squint into the molten glass because it's like bright orange. It's like somebody took a piece of the sun and just shoved it in there. And you get to smell it and you get to, our instructor, her name was Helen. She was great. You have this iron, this pole, metal pole, and you're sticking it in and you're twirling it like taffy and you're taking a bit of the molten glass out. And you have to hold it pretty level because she said big angles, big problem. If you hold it up, all the glass will drip down the pole and you don't have anything to work with. And if you tilt it down, all the glass will drip off the pole onto the floor and you don't have anything to work with. Big angles, big problems. That's something I would have never learned in a book. But having a teacher there teach me that was really incredible. And I was taking notes. I mentioned her in my acknowledgments. I named one of my glass blowers after her in the book itself, too.
I bet she was so freaking happy
Yeah, I gave her a copy. She was very excited about that. She's like, anytime you have questions, I could call her or ask her or something like that. So it was a lot of fun working with her.
Jeez, I bet like now listeners are like all listening thinking, oh, I wish I could teach Maria something useful for her next books.
I have different things in the books from people who I know or readers I've been in contact with. The lady who taught me how to ride a horse, because I did that for research for magic study. In fact, Kiki, the horse, is named after the horse that I learned how to ride on. And I actually described her exactly how that Kiki is.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Kiki had her moment. She had her 15 seconds of fame. We had her autograph a book, one of the magic studies. We put ink on the bottom of her hoof and she stepped on the book and made
Hell
a hoof
yes.
print. The lady who owns Kiki and taught me, she has the Kiki signed book. It's a one of a kind.
Oh my gosh, you were so cool, Maria.
That was really interesting to get a horse to do that.
I don't know anybody else that's done that. So there we go. So we have Desi K. Bekyarova. I wanted to know how Maria manages to maintain and develop the romance between Valak and Yelena so well over the course of 6 books, considering the will they, won't they aspect of it gets resolved in book 1. The trend seems to be that once the main characters get together, it all goes kind of stale. But Yelena and Valak have such a functioning and loving relationship. They're an incredible team, and she loves reading their scenes together, and she would love to see more of that in YA.
That's the one thing that got me. When I finished Poison Study, I was thinking it was going to be just the one book standalone. So I resolved the romance in that one because it seemed natural and everything. But I notice I do it with all my other books as well. After the first book, they're usually together because, frankly, that whole will they, won't they drives me crazy in other books. And you just want to slap them sometimes because they draw it out so long. And it's fine for other authors seem to be able to manage that all right, but I can't because I would just slap myself. Like, would you stop with this already? So that was one of the things where, oh my goodness, now they're together. How am I going to make this interesting? I think one of the things is they're not together, physically together a lot because they both are very important people in their countries and they both have a lot going on. So they don't have a lot of time where they're just like hanging out together. Those few scenes where they are together, it's fresh enough because they haven't spent the whole novel together. Like Magic Study, they don't see each other again until halfway through the book. So I think that helps out with it. I think it's really hard. The first 3 books, like I said, they don't spend a lot of time together. In the second 3 books, I actually alternate chapters. So Yelena's in one chapter and Valak's in the other chapter. So you get to see from both sides points of view, finally, after the first 3 books. I think that helps as well. But I don't know if I have any real things that I do. I'm such a instinctual writer, like with the whole pantsing thing, that it just says I'm writing, these things come. I think also, too, in having a sense of humor a little bit, the humor is nice for the... And also, too, having moments where they doubt each other. I did in Dawn Study, they do have a bit of a fight because she didn't trust him and she was freaking out and he took it completely the wrong way. And so they had some problems there. Trying to make it as realistic as possible. Because, you know, in all couple situations, there's times that happen where you take something the wrong way when you shouldn't have, it wasn't meant that way, things like that.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a foundation of relationships, please. I think that's very helpful for listeners as well, listening in. There were great tidbits over there. The next one is from Gigi Griffiths. She said, Poison Study and the rest of the series is one of my favorites. And she said she's so excited and she would love to know about your revision process. Are you an overwriter, an underwriter? What do you spend your time on during revisions? And do you have any revision tips?
Oh, that's a good question. Since I discover my story as I write, revision is a big, big part of it for me because there's a lot of times I'll layer in a subplot and then it goes nowhere. Or I have a subplot that picks up halfway through and I say, oh, I'll add that in later. Because I don't want to stop my writing to go back and fix it. When I'm writing a book, I try and get the whole first draft done without doing any kind of major revisions. Like I'll do little things here and there, fix sentences and stuff. But I print out the pages as I go and then I'll write on it. Oh, change this or add this in to match something later in the story. So I won't forget it. I have it written down. And then when everything's done, I go back through. And for some reason, I don't see errors as well on the computer screen. So I need to have that paper. So when I read something on paper, I really can see like where I missed a word or something doesn't sound right or anything. So I'll make all the corrections there. And then I go back and do a major revision a second time through. And I tend to have to add things because, like I said, there'll be subplots that come later in the story that I need to add in the beginning. And I tend not to be big on the details or too much emotion. I just want to get that story out and get it out. And then I can go back and say, oh, well, they're having an argument, but nobody seems really mad here. So I'll layer in physical actions and some emotion and everything like that. So when I do a revision, it tends to be longer story after I'm done because I don't overwrite. I tend to underwrite. You can't really, I didn't describe this room. They're just in this room and we have no idea what kind of room.
Your revision process is where most of the heavy lifting is being done.
Yes. I kind of look at it like building a house.
Okay, gotcha.
When I write a story, I build a house and I put the framework up and I put the rooms in certain places and windows and the roof on. Then revisions is when I get to go in and decorate and fix things and move things around a little bit, make it look pretty. I enjoy the revision part because the hard work's done. I've discovered the story. I got to the end. The foundation's there. Now I just need to make it look pretty.
It sounds almost like, okay, now it's playtime. Now I can go in and work my art and really throw colors in there.
It is. And it's, oh, I have something, a cliche, you know, her heart pounded when she was scared. Well, everybody uses her heart pounded. Let's think of something else. Dig deeper than the initial. But when you're writing, you get to that point, if you try and dig deeper, it can take a while and it can derail you. So I'll just put the cliche in. You know, I'll just call something red. Or, you know, oh, it's a sunset, but I don't go on to say what it looked like. So that's one of the things that I do when revising. Also, too, like I won't describe something like a bird. I'll say a bird, but like what kind of bird is it? Like, what does it look like? Then I can put something like that. I can find a cool bird in a bird book and find something, especially if it's important. I have a bat in my fire study. She has a pet bat. I know it sounds really weird. You got to describe them. You got to figure out how bats work. I mean, I know they have the whole echolocation thing. There's some things. So here's a tip. When I do my research sometimes, other than the hands-on stuff and the internet stuff, sometimes I'll go to the kids' juvenile nonfiction section and I'll get books out from the library, or like a book about bats. And it's juvenile nonfiction, so they'll have big color pictures and they'll have descriptions of the bat, but they don't go into the whole detail that like an adult nonfiction book would have. Like, because I don't need to become a bat expert. Give me some pictures. Give me some background about what they feed on. Picked up a book, Life in the Medieval Castle, and it had all the different jobs. And they had pictures of what they wore, and they had pictures of the castle and everything. And it was cool, and that's all I needed.
Thank you for sharing that, because I feel like that probably would have saved so much time.
Sometimes you don't need all that detail for something like that. Now, something like with the glass blowing, I really needed to know what I was talking about.
That is very specific, because that's like a huge part of it. I know I read that you have written for traveling magazines. I would love to know, where is your next spot that you'd love to travel to?
Ah, that's a good question.
If you didn't have to worry about family or anything like that, or if you want to go with family, what is your dream next place?
Well, now that's a harder question. I was going to say, if I have a couple trips planned, I know where I'm going there. My dream? Well, there's so many places that I do want to see. I'd love to go to Hawaii. I've never been to Hawaii, but I don't know if that's my dream or not. I want to go everywhere. There's not many places I will say no to. I haven't been to Japan yet. That's on my list. Now, I've been to New Zealand once, but not very long. So I'd love to go back and explore New Zealand because the little bit I saw was just absolutely gorgeous.
Yes, it's beautiful.
And I need to go back there for like 6 weeks. See, my dream is more not the destination, it's the time. That would be my answer.
That's a good answer.
It would be the time. Like, yes. I will go anywhere. I just would like a huge block of time. Like, go to New Zealand for 6 weeks and explore the whole country. And then move on to Australia and do more of Australia. I've been there twice, but I've only seen a fraction of the country. And then I would move on to Japan and then go back to China because I was only there for a week and I didn't get to see the terracotta warriors. Also, get to know the people and see more of the local stuff and not just all the tourist stuff. Because I was in Australia for a month last year and we did get to see a whole bunch and I got to hang out with, the people are so lovely. Like, I just wanted to spend time getting to know them better.
Or maybe, you know, in the future for retirement, you never know.
Yeah. Except for My kids don't have any interest. I tried. I keep trying to get my family to move to Australia, especially with the political climate. You know, it's like, come on, let's just leave like, for 4 years. Want,
exactly, right?
Come on. I mean,
that's
come on,
my thinking, too.
Yeah, everybody wanted to go to Canada, but I wanted to go to Australia.
And that wraps up our episode with Maria V. Snyder. Maria, I had such a fun time chatting with you and loved having you on the show. Storytellers, thank you for listening in. Get in touch with Maria on Facebook by heading over to facebook.com/MVSFans. If you enjoyed Maria's episode or if it helped you in any way, I would love to ask you for your support in taking a moment to subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea on iTunes and leaving a rating and a review. Producing a podcast takes a lot of time, and we put a lot of heart and soul into making 88 Cups of Tea the best that it can be. When you take those specific actions of subscribing, leaving a rating and a review, that really helps our show become more visible to new listeners who haven't heard of us before. And we're really trying to get the word out about our podcast. Thank you so much for helping us grow our community. Don't forget to join our private Facebook group if you want to hang out with fellow writers and fellow listeners from 88 Cups of Tea. I'm so excited to see you in there. You can find us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.